As he sat and listened to his teacher, he was a portrait of elegance and concentration. He had a handsome face and graceful mannerisms. His eyes were small but sharp and acute. The cloak and sandals he wore were always of the best quality, and he wore ornate rings on his fingers, for he was a man from a prestigious family, and he himself was wealthy. But the external finery was like rags compared to the refinement and wealth that dwelled within his mind. He was known then, as he is now, simply as Aristotle. Aristotle, with full attention, was listening to Plato's reading of the Phaedo, the book Plato wrote that describes the death of his master Socrates. Socrates had been condemned to drink poisonous hemlock, and he spent his last day with his followers talking about the immortality of the human soul. Parts of the Phaedo were moving and inspirational, but it was a lengthy book, and there were many pages of long, tedious dialogue. As Plato read, his audience began to dwindle, first one, then another. In the end, when the teacher looked up, only one student remained, still engrossed by the emotion of the event, still absorbed by the issues of death, immortality, and courage. It was Aristotle. Like Plato and Socrates, Aristotle himself became one of the greatest philosophers of ancient Greece. He was also a teacher, scientist, and writer, tutor to Alexander the Great, and founder of the famous Lyceum, the Athenian school considered to be the world's first true university. Together, Plato and Aristotle are considered the two greatest philosophers of antiquity, and in the view of many, Aristotle is considered the greatest of all time. Aristotle viewed the natural world through the eyes of a biologist and applied biological principles to all spheres of human knowledge. His philosophy had great influence on succeeding generations of thinkers, including Dante and Thomas Aquinas, to name only a few. Dante called Aristotle the master of those who know. Just to list the achievements and contributions of this remarkable man would fill a book in itself. Some of the contributions for which he's best known include: he was the first to classify the various disciplines of human knowledge, such as biology, physics, politics, and art. He developed the science of argument through logic. Immanuel Kant once stated that since the time of Aristotle, logic has neither moved forward or backwards. It is still today what Aristotle made it. He was also the first to separate the study of weather from astronomy. He was the first to classify animals into genus and species. He identified new uses of language and created new terms to apply to them, such as the syllogism, and assumed truth based on previous facts. He founded the science of psychology and was the first to consider the problems of the human psyche as a separate discipline. And he was the first to separate the study of ethics or virtue from the study of knowledge. Aristotle was a prolific author, and records of the time indicate he may have written as many as 400 works on education, science, rhetoric, literary criticism, political theory, poetry, philosophy, and thoughts at large. Many of these works are believed to be lectures and notes he wrote for his students at the Lyceum. Of these hundreds of valuable works, only about 50 have survived. Of those that have, the most famous are Metaphysics, First Philosophy, Rhetoric, Poetics, De Anima, and his most popular and influential work, the Nicomachean Ethics. Aristotle lived in a time when many important forces converged to help form one of the foremost philosophical minds in history. Most importantly, he was a product of Greek culture. Before the Greeks, mankind was concerned mostly with death, but to the Greeks, life was the most significant fact, and human life was the greatest wonder on earth. Their sports and their art give testament to the great pleasure in and enthusiasm for living. The Greeks were also the first philosophers. To them, the great miracle of man was his logos, his ability to think, reason, and know. Through understanding the nature of the universe and humankind, the Greeks believed they had the key to understanding the individual's place and purpose in life. Fueled by this faith in man's logos, a long line of esteemed thinkers and philosophers paraded through ancient Greek history, each contributing a new perspective to those who went before, and each founding a school of thought that influenced the next generation. They included Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans, who approached all things with the purpose of finding the relation between the whole and its parts, and who saw the number as the most important principle. Parmenides, with his view that ideas were reality. The Sophists, were their survival of the fittest philosophy. Socrates, who maintained the meaning of things was more real than the things themselves, that there were eternal truths, that man could reach perfection and immortality. He developed a method of question and answer now called the Socratic method, and he was the only man ever executed in Athens for what he believed. Plato, Socrates' student, who felt the world was an illusionary shadow, and we could come to know the truth by giving up the pleasures of the senses. And finally, Aristotle, who took something from all that went before him, and then added his own ideas. One of the most impressive and unique networks in human knowledge was the learning that was passed down through the four great men of the 5th and 4th centuries B.C. Socrates was a teacher to Plato. Plato was a teacher to Aristotle. And Aristotle was a teacher to Alexander the Great. All of them changed history. Aristotle was born in 384 B.C. in the Macedonian town of Stagira, a Greek colony in the Thracian Sea, in what is now called Thessalonica. At the time of his birth, the Greek city-state was already in decline. Athens had been conquered by Sparta 20 years before, and Greece was torn by a power struggle between Sparta and the city-state of Thebes. While the Greek city-states were growing weaker, a new power was rising in the north, the Kingdom of Macedonia, which would soon give birth to Alexander the Great, who would establish a huge empire stretching from Greece to the Indian Ocean. Aristotle's father, Nicomachus, was a prominent doctor who served as court physician to the king of Macedonia. His family was of noble origin with a tradition in medicine. Aristotle probably had early medical training and undoubtedly spent his first years at the Macedonian capital of Pella, where the king lived. Both of Aristotle's parents died young, and he was put under the guardianship of a Macedonian official until he was 17 and left for Plato's Academy outside of Athens. There he came under one of the greatest influences of his life. He remained at the Academy 20 years, until Plato's death in 347 B.C. During those years, under the guidance of the outstanding educator of his age, Aristotle polished his scientific talents with a refined awareness of ethics, aesthetics, and philosophy. Plato called him the mind of the school, and nicknamed him the reader because of his vast knowledge, which he gained from constant reading. Almost immediately, Plato made Aristotle a teacher of rhetoric. Plato's academy was the center of learning for the entire Mediterranean world. Men from all over came to discuss the critical questions of the day. Many of them were the famous thinkers of their time. In addition, Plato traveled widely and brought back new information, ideas, and perspectives to his students. The atmosphere at the school was cosmopolitan, invigorating, and liberal. Abstract problems were discussed in the Socratic manner, and Aristotle had the opportunity to learn the difference between knowledge gained through discussions and analysis, and that gained through observation and deduction. He also had a chance to learn thoroughly all the theories of earlier philosophers. He would later refer to these as the opinions of the wise. The discussion method at the academy also helped Aristotle and other students realize the importance of definition, language, and orderly thinking. Arguments had to be made in a logical, systematic way. During these years, Aristotle was deeply under the influence of his teacher, yet few of his writings from this time have survived. Because he later took issue with some of Plato's viewpoints, there have always been rumors that the two had personal conflicts, but the truth is to the contrary. Aristotle held Plato in high esteem, even during the latter portion of his life, when he turned away from Platonic theory and founded his own Aristotelian school of thought. At Plato's death, Aristotle wrote that it was he who alone, or first of mortals, clearly revealed by his own life and by the methods of his words, how to be happy is to be good. When Plato died in 347 B.C., Aristotle left the academy and never returned. The successor to Plato was a pupil who emphasized Plato's theory of numbers, and Aristotle was more interested in biology. Furthermore, he had become unwelcome in Athens. The Greek states had collapsed, and anyone known to have connections with the court in Macedonia was considered a pariah in democratic Athens. After leaving Plato's academy, Aristotle accepted an invitation of a fellow student, Hermaeus, to live at his court in Assos, a town on the slopes of Mount Ida in Asia Minor. Hermaeus had risen from a slave to a wealthy property owner, and Aristotle enjoyed the status of special guest and court philosopher. Hermias was a crafty tyrant in his region, but under Aristotle's influence, he modified his rule to a more democratic form of government. He gave Aristotle much liberty, and Aristotle quickly formed a small group of Platonists, who would later form the core of the school he himself founded in Athens. Among these first disciples was his nephew, Callisthenes, who was an historian. At age 37, Aristotle married Hermias's niece, Pythia, but she died bearing their only child, a girl also named Pythia. Perhaps because of his age at the time, Aristotle wrote that the ideal ages for marriage were 37 for a man and 18 for a woman. He also wrote his views on adultery, saying, "Let it be held disgraceful for any man or woman to be found in any way unfaithful once they are married and call each other husband and wife." After Pythia died, Aristotle married a second time to a woman named Herpillis, and they had a son named Nicomachus in honor of Aristotle's father. The philosopher devoted much time to his family and left an extraordinary detailed will that assured everyone was well taken care of, including his servants and their families, whom he freed at the time of his death. After 3 years at Hermias's court, Aristotle moved to an island where it is believed he did much of his research in biology. Then, at age 42, he accepted an invitation from the king of Macedonia to tutor his son, Alexander the Great, who was then 13 years old. During this period, Aristotle stayed at the royal palace near Pella and developed his interest in constitutions and government, writing two treatises on political science for Alexander to use as textbooks. He tried to influence the boy by teaching him magnanimity, a basic tenet of Aristotle's philosophy, and he also assigned him the reading of Homer's Iliad. Alexander developed a passion for the book and adopted Achilles as the model for his later heroics. Alexander later rewarded his teacher by endowing his library and museum in Athens and by contributing rare flora and fauna to his biology collection. The impact of Aristotle's teaching inspired Alexander to initiate research projects, including a study of the flooding of the Nile River and the exploration of the Euphrates and Indus rivers. Later, Alexander would say that it was his father who gave him life, and it was Aristotle who taught him how to live that life well. But Alexander much preferred the life of action to the life of study that Aristotle promoted, and relations between the two were strained. When Alexander set off to conquer the world, Aristotle returned to his native town of Stagira. He later broke off all correspondence with his former pupil when Alexander, by then converted to Persian ways, had Aristotle's nephew and disciple, Callisthenes, killed for refusing to prostrate himself in the Oriental manner. Callisthenes had joined Alexander's expeditions as an historian. Shortly after Aristotle arrived at the Macedonian court, he heard the Persians had captured and crucified his friend and father-in-law, Hermias. Aristotle was badly shaken and honored Hermias with a memorial at Delphi and a poem in his honor. This wasn't well received by the Greeks, who believed Hermias had been plotting with the Macedonian forces in Greece. Many years later, the poem would be used against Aristotle in the Athenian court. In 335 BC, when he was about 49 years old, Aristotle returned to Athens and opened his new school, the Lyceum. It was situated in a grove which was sacred to Apollo Lysias and the Muses. Socrates used to come to the same grove to spend quiet hours in meditation. Since he was now the recognized leading philosopher and teacher of Greece, Aristotle immediately announced that he was the successor to Plato and that the Lyceum was the successor to the Academy. Since his school used a contradictory view of learning to Plato's, a stimulating rivalry developed between the Academy and the Lyceum. The Academy focused chiefly on mathematics, whereas the Lyceum focused on biology and history. Soon, the Lyceum had taken the place of the Academy, whose students were applying for admission. Aristotle's students were nicknamed the Peripatetics, because they would wander around the covered walk or peripatos as they talked and debated. His students ranged in age from young teenagers to men older than he was. While running the Lyceum, Aristotle also established the first great library in Athens and founded a laboratory for the study of animals and plant life. Before Alexander executed Aristotle's nephew, when their relationship was still friendly, several of his assistants traveled with Alexander on his military conquests to collect specimens and bring them back to the laboratory where they could be dissected and studied. During these years in Athens, Aristotle harvested the fruit of his many years of research and observation. He wrote most of his major works during this time, completed the classification of the sciences, developed his own system of logic, and saw the great influence of his ethical and political theories being felt in Athens and throughout Greece. Aristotle seems to have been an organizer. Study hours weren't free at the Lyceum, they were planned. Aristotle gave most of his lectures in the morning, and in the afternoon he spoke on more popular topics like rhetoric to attract the crowds that came from the city to hear him. Aristotle formulated rules by which both teachers and students lived, and these rules survived long after his death. Under Aristotle, Plato's idea of a common life shared by friends in search of wisdom became the basis for the first university in Europe. It's difficult to assess the influence Aristotle's teaching had on his students, for they later showed little evidence of it. His teaching at the Lyceum didn't give rise to new philosophy. Instead, it marked the climax and ultimate achievement of many ages of Greek philosophy. Aristotle succeeded in his role of educator, but was forced out of Athens in 323 BC after public opinion turned against Macedonian influence following the death of Alexander. Since Aristotle had been a friend and teacher of Alexander, and since his father had been a physician to the Macedonian court, he was now considered an enemy. He was charged with impiety for his poem to Hermias, believed to be a Macedonian conspirator, even though he'd written the poem 20 years earlier. He was also accused of not showing reverence for the gods, just as Socrates had been. Referring to the execution of Socrates, Aristotle stated that he wished to spare Athens another opportunity to commit a crime against philosophy and return to his native land. He turned control of the Lyceum over to his favorite pupil, an expert in botany named Theophrastus. On a plot of land owned by his late mother, Aristotle spent his last months reading and studying mythology. He died of a stomach disease and chalcis in 322 BC at the age of 66. Aristotle's work and writings covered a long range of time and a broad range of subjects. For more than 1,000 years after he died, his books were studied in schools and universities and served as the foundation for all education. Much of his work reflects the influence of his teacher Plato, and much of it veers in different directions from Plato. Where Plato was imaginative, Aristotle was practical. Where Plato was abstract, Aristotle was experiential. Where Plato was inspiring, Aristotle was concrete. For instance, when Plato considered what the ideal government might be, he began by questioning what the soul of man was like. When Aristotle considered an ideal government, he gathered over 150 different constitutions written by the Greek states and tried to compare them. Like Plato, Aristotle accepted the idea that the universe had a soul. Like Plato, he believed there was perfection and divinity in nature and in man. Both men rejected the idea that all things were made from atoms, and believed instead that they were made of combinations of the four elements: earth, water, air, and fire. Aristotle also added a new substance to the universe, which he called ether. He believed the stars, planets, and other celestial bodies were perfect and divine, and therefore made of ether, and not the ordinary substances everything on earth was made of. He also thought, being divine, that the celestial bodies were unflawed and unmarked. It would be up to Galileo and later scientists to prove him wrong. The point at which Aristotle split from Plato is mostly in the area of science. Plato didn't believe in experiments because he thought they showed disrespect for the divine. Aristotle, on the other hand, stressed the importance of making one's own discoveries. The spirit that drove him was the spirit of inquiry. He collected information, analyzed it, classified it, and developed his own research system. He classified over 500 animals and described their structures and functions. Charles Darwin, over 2,000 years later, said Aristotle had made more contributions to biology than any other single individual. He developed two forms of scientific reasoning: the syllogism and inductive reasoning. In a syllogism, one makes a conclusion based on two statements known to be true. An example would be: 1. All trees need light. 2. An oak is a tree. 3. Therefore, an oak needs light. Inductive reasoning is when one reaches a general conclusion based on a specific case. For instance, this dog breathes through lungs, therefore all dogs breathe through lungs. Aristotle's logic was unique in philosophy. Unlike Plato, he relied more on deductive logic as it applies to observable objects. He had the cool, detached eye of the scientist. In his studies, he accumulated a vast number of facts and observations, which were, to a great extent, the beginnings of physical science. The entire structure of modern scientific inquiry owes much to his exhaustive exploration of truth. In addition, the principles and methods of Aristotle have inspired some of the greatest systems of philosophy and are still considered major forces of religion and metaphysics. Because of this work, Aristotle was later called the father of the scientific method. As Aristotle entered his later years, his interests as a philosopher had shifted. No longer concerned with the transcendent, unseen world of ideas he favored in his youth, he developed a consuming passion for facts and things of the world. In a sense, he was the first philosopher to confront the problem of the relation of religion to science. But up to the end of his life, he seems to have believed that science couldn't supply all the answers. As he wrote in one of his last letters, he withdrew more and more into what he called the wonderland of myth. He wrote, "The more I am by myself and alone, the fonder I have become of myths." Mythology was the Bible of Greek religion. Although he'd split from his teacher in many ways, Aristotle never did renounce Plato's vision of a world which was essentially spirit and driven by a primal divine force. People generally agree that the greatest work Aristotle completed was the Nicomachean Ethics, believed to have been written later in his life, when he was 50 or 60 and head of the Lyceum. It's a book that deals primarily with the good life, good meaning moral, how such a life is lived and what it means. The word ethics comes from the Greek word ethos, which means custom, manner, habit, or character. Aristotle believed that an individual reveals what he really is through what he does. He also believed that good or excellence is the final purpose of man, and that man is motivated toward self-perfection. Ethics, therefore, is the study of character, of the moral element in human nature. It's the study of action in terms of self-perfection. Aristotle was the first to suggest that ethics might be primarily a matter of individual conscience, and only secondarily a matter of social behavior. He stated there was no absolute, objective standard of morality. Instead, whether behavior was moral or not depended on the type of action performed and the motivation of the person performing it. He also thought the life of action in society was less important than the life of contemplation. The best life was no longer public life, but a private life of intense personal mental activity. In other words, Aristotle separated individual moral standards from the moral standards of society. This was a radical move for the time, particularly in civic-minded Greece, and it differed from the teachings of his mentor, Plato. It was even considered subversive, since it raised the question of who was the higher moral agent, the state or the individual. For the first time in Western philosophy, the individual became independent and even superior to the society in which he lived. This trend toward individual morality and conscience eventually became the cornerstone of modern political and ethical theory. In the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle said, "Every art and every scientific inquiry, and similarly every action and purpose, may be said to aim at some good." Aristotle spent much time trying to define happiness, and his basic belief was that true happiness was not based on pleasures, but on how well a person lived their life. He separated happiness, or the good life, into three categories. One is happiness based on sensual pleasure, the vulgar goal of the common man. Two is happiness based on honor, which is the goal of the cultivated man. And three is true happiness, which is obtained through contemplation and philosophy. He dismissed the idea of money altogether as a form of happiness by saying money, although it can buy pleasures, is not an end in itself. One of the areas in which Aristotle split with Plato was in Plato's idea of a universal good. Aristotle disagreed with this concept, saying there can be no single universal ideal. Instead, good depends on the needs, circumstances, and point of view of the individual. Aristotle isolated and defined what he considered the qualities of goodness. He said that pleasure, honor, intelligence, and virtue were not ends in themselves, and that happiness lies beyond them. By comparing humans to plants and animals, he concluded that existence itself is not happiness, and that thought and action must be required for humans to attain happiness. Aristotle also described how people might attain happiness. He believed human beings must make an effort to find happiness themselves through education and training. Politics, which he thought was the highest of all endeavors, must be everyone's concern, for politics attempt to create an environment in which reason and virtue may thrive, and reason and virtue are essential in attaining happiness. To both Aristotle and Plato, everything revolved around an enlightened government, which should serve as the protector and role model of the highest values of a society. For that reason, they were both concerned with educating, training, and advising rulers and government officials. Aristotle thought the building of good character was a two-step process: intellectual growth through learning, and morality through practice. He believed people are born amoral and must develop moral attitudes and habits. Although they can see and hear at birth, they must learn good behavior. Politicians could help the people learn by passing good laws, which encouraged moral conduct. He believed the opposite was true, too. Bad habits encourage bad behavior. So, he said, there will always be a need for teachers to foster positive actions so that people will develop justice, bravery, and temperance, as opposed to cruelty, cowardice, and lack of restraint. Early childhood training is critically important, or as Aristotle said, it is not a light matter, but important, or rather, all important. In order to achieve good character, Aristotle felt people must fulfill three conditions. They must be aware of the virtue of their actions. They must favor good behavior over bad. They must act in response to a regular pattern of moral behavior. He summarized his belief this way: good character is a mean between two vices and emphasizes a middle point in emotions and actions. A person should avoid extremes, guard against natural inclinations, choose the lesser of two evils, and avoid pleasures that encourage deviation from the mean. A person who lives within the mean avoids both overindulgence and asceticism, or self-denial. Of the two, he felt overindulgence is the worst, for, like wayward children, indulgent people allow appetites and desires to govern their lives and disregard the place of reason in their conduct. Aristotle felt that wrongful acts fell into four categories: accidents, which are committed in ignorance and without malice and do not require punishment; negligence, in which people should be held responsible but not criminally liable; unpremeditated wrongs, such as acts committed in anger, the person is judged but not labeled wicked or unjust; and finally, deliberate acts of harm on the innocent, which should be the most severely condemned. These categories can still be seen in many modern systems of justice. Both Aristotle and Plato placed a strong emphasis on the importance of friendship and community, which was a principle that led them to found their schools. Aristotle called friendship indispensable to life. It requires the display of affection, mutual goodwill, and understanding. There are three types of friendship: those based on utility, in which both parties are helpful to each other; those based on mutual pleasure, which form a social relationship; and perfect friendship, in which the friends wish good for each other because of their friendship's sake. This is the one friendship that is stable and lasting, but it is the rarest form and requires time and intimacy. He stated that democracy, the type of government which maintains the greatest equilibrium among peoples, promotes true friendship, because, in his words, when people are equals, they have the most in common. In any perverted government, the importance of friendship decreases as justice decreases. Aristotle always claimed that it was best for an individual to have a few good friends rather than many, since true friendship requires time, intimacy, and effort. Friendship is valuable because, in his words, friends seem to become better by acting together and correcting each other's faults. Aristotle always promoted a meditative, thoughtful life as the ideal life. Happiness, he believed, came from virtuous activities that result from intellectual pursuits. The ideal or divine state is perfect reason. He stated, "A man's reason, more than all else, is himself." He declared that the person most beloved of the gods is the philosopher, because he can understand virtue. However, he also believed it's not enough to know what virtue is. We must act, we must use it. And even though people might possess an innate ability for good, they should receive moral education, which the state should provide. Teachers should be aware of universal principles, but should also individualize their teaching to strengthen each student. The state, grounded in sound ethics, has an obligation to develop the character of its citizens. Aristotle's greatest work was this attempt to define the nature of man's true happiness, which he felt depended on a virtuous life. He defined those virtues and maintained that people can only become good through, first, knowing what good is, and second, through habit and training. Then he brought this theory down to the level of action, saying, saying individual and social morality must be demonstrated and lived. It affects all our relationships in life and is particularly necessary if we want to become good statesmen and lawgivers. Education, he concluded, is essential. These principles of happiness, virtue, and goodness must be taught. The importance Aristotle placed on teaching was inevitable, since he lived in an age when the relationship of teacher and student was one of the most honored and sacred relationships of all. Socrates passed his wisdom and inspiration on to Plato. Plato then offered his learning to Aristotle, and Aristotle took that knowledge, refined and adapted it to reflect his personal views and insights, and passed it along to his students, who included Alexander the Great. In this chain of cumulative learning and development, the ultimate recipients are we ourselves, the products of a modern society that exists more than 2,000 years later. Through the written word, this remarkable cycle of teaching and learning remains unbroken, although the teachers have long since passed from this earth.
This is the end of the session.